are you ready to drop? I mean, was this a pretty overwhelming time, Vancouver, and then immediately training for that?
Yeah, I'm definitely ready to drop. I mean, after the Olympics, I actually had a lot of motivation to go on to World Championships and, you know, do even better. And it's really just what I finally decided was it wasn't in me to give up early, to quit the season early, because on the one hand, I had my silver medal, I had a bronze medal. Like, I didn't feel like I could be on any more of a high, no matter how well I did at World Championships. But my coach asked me to go for my team. The more girls that go and the higher you rank, the more spots we qualify for the next season. So I really needed to go just in order to qualify the maximal amount of spots. When I got there, I got sick. I was sick. We left on Saturday. I got sick on Friday, and I was sick until the next Saturday. So like 9 days, I had a pretty bad cold / flu. And so I got sixth overall at World Championships. Definitely like not a disappointment, but at the same time, if I hadn't been sick, I feel like I could have done much better. So maybe I should have just listened to my body a little bit more and known that after the Olympics, I was cashed out, completely drained. But now that it's all over and I'm back home in Champaign, I'm feeling great. So
I think you said in your journal that the World Championships are a little anticlimactic too. I obviously don't get the attention of huge audience for the Olympics, but are they not getting the audience they
No,
deserve?
I mean at the Olympics you had 12,000 people watching every single race, 12,000 people screaming. And at World Championships in Bulgaria, I mean, we had maybe 60 people there. And then there's the fact that I went from Vancouver, which is an amazing city, to Sofia, Bulgaria, which is I like it there, but it's really not. It's not a speed skating place, and Vancouver was really, they had a lot of support for speed skating there. So there were so many things. Like, how can you really beat the Olympics? And, you know, 3 weeks later going to Worlds and you're sick and you just want to go home and take a break. So it was anticlimactic, but I feel like I'm a stronger athlete and a mentally stronger person for pushing my limits like that.
Can you run through a typical day? I mean, because where many of us go and a job or whatever, I mean, your job is skating, and this rigorous schedule. I mean, what happens, how soon do you hit the ice or whatever kind of exercise you're doing?
Well, let's see. I don't think we start skating until the very beginning of June, but like my career really isn't even just skating. Like, it's staying very fit. So it's technically being a good skater, but also off the ice, being very fit, running a lot, staying very thin, sleeping enough, eating right. Like, it's not like I just show up and practice and that's it. Like, it's a whole lifestyle that my career is. When we're training, a typical day would be up at 7, going to the rink. I'll be at the rink at like 7:45 and sharpen my skates. We have an hour warm up and workout every morning, and then we're on the ice at 9, skate till 11, and then we'll have another workout that goes till 12 to 12:30. We'll come back at 3, lift weights, go for an hour long run, and that's my basic day. It has variations. Some days, instead of 2 dry land workouts in the morning, we'll have two separate skating sessions, so we'll actually skate 3 or 4 hours in a day. But then those days are even harder, because after, you basically save all of your morning dry land and put it after your second skating session. So instead of a morning workout, an afternoon workout, you have a morning workout, an afternoon workout, and then all the stuff that you should have done in the morning after your afternoon workout. So those are the most intense days. We do that probably twice a week.
When you were in an event, whether it's in the Olympics or World Championships or wherever, do you put in perspective, okay, all this work goes into this little 1 minute or less. This is the pinnacle of what you worked up to at this point.
I've definitely had that feeling before, and I had it at the Olympic Games with half a lap left to go in the 1,000 meter. I really only remember two things about that race. I remember when there was that big pile up and I was able to make that huge inside pass into second place. I remember that perfectly. And I remember with half a lap to go thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so tired. I don't know if I can finish. Looking at the corner coming up and thinking, if I don't take 2 crossovers in, this Korean girl is going to have enough speed to pass me. But I really don't know if I can. And within that same moment, I had the thought that, Catherine, this is the moment that you've trained for your whole life. Like, this is 16 years worth of work right now. Are you going to give it up to her right now because you won't take two crossovers in? And, the answer was like, heck no, I'm not. And so I took two in, and I'm sure I looked like I was just flailing for my life, but I was, and it paid off.
One interview you said you quoted a track coach. Was that at Centennial?
Yep, at Centennial. It was Coach Shine.
And he had told you that all your practice is like a little deposit in the bank, and then you're essentially writing the check when you're out
yep.
there performing.
Yep. Every day is a deposit. And then on race day, you write a check, and you hope that your check is bigger than everyone else's. I feel pretty confident saying that consistently my check has been the second biggest in the world. Meng Wang is definitely a dominating force. I have beat her a handful of times, but you know, she's most consistently on top. So while I was planning on putting everything out on the line to beat her on that day, I'm pretty satisfied with how much work I did put in, how much, you know, money I did deposit.
Is there the level of politics involved as far as when in this competition? I'm thinking of the Olympics, and I'm trying to think of something on a higher stage, maybe in a figure skating competition, whereas Evan Lysacek defeated Plushenko.
Yep.
And there was all this attention in Russian media after that. Does that happen with something as quick as speed skating?
Yeah, it does. Speed skating is really huge in Korea. And so, I mean, really anything less than second place is considered a failure in Korea. Like, even second is kind of like, well, why didn't you win? So the fact that the Chinese came in and dominated like they did at the 2010 Olympics, that was kind of a big upset. I mean, we all knew that all the Chinese skaters were skating well, but the fact that they came out and just really dominated, I guess it didn't show much in the U.S., but I know in China and in Korea, like, that's a big deal. It's a huge rivalry, and both teams were quoted as saying, like, the Chinese would say, our only goal here is to beat Korea, and the Koreans would say, our only goal here is to beat the Chinese. So there's definitely that rivalry going on with the Asian countries.
And the interview I made reference to, you talked about skaters bumping one another, and it's just, and you basically said, hey, that's the way it is. It's part of the game.
It is part of the game, and I think it's a part of almost every game. There aren't very many sports out there where you put four people together in a pack, and it's not really up to me anymore how well I do. It's up to, if everyone skates safe, and there are just so many variables in our sport. If it was something like even track, where it's very similar, but everyone has their own lane, and you're guaranteed your best performance. No one's going to mess with you. But in a sport like ours, it's even more being defensive than offensive, because if I'm in the lead with two laps to go, you better believe I'm going to fight to keep that lead. No one's going to take it away from me. So someone trying to pass me, they're very likely to put their hands on your hips or on your knees just to kind of show you, you know, like, I'm here and I'm coming for you. And my response to that is, you're not going anywhere. I'm staying right where I'm at. And it brings out the aggression in all of us, but it's just competition. I'm pretty good friends with all of my competitors off of the ice, and we understand that once the helmets go on, like, we all want to win. We all respect each other for how strong we are and what we're each individually able to bring to the table, but at the end of the day, at the end of the race, we're going to do whatever it takes to win.
You threw away the notion of figure skating at age four.
Mm-hmm.
You ever, I don't want to say you have any regrets, but do you sit there and is there a mutual admiration? You'll see many other greats of the sport and think, well, that might be nice to just for exercise to see if I could do these turns and
spins
and all these amazing feats.
I don't know. I feel like I've really found my niche in speed skating. Like, there's speed skates and figure skates are completely different. Like, I can't hardly skate on figure skates without toe picking and falling on my face. I can't hardly skate on hockey skates without rolling off my heels and falling down. But on speed skates, I feel like that's really where, for some reason or other, God bless me with the talent to feel that balance, to feel where to put the pressure down at. And God also gave me a very strong work ethic. My coach tells me pretty often that God is very fair, and he gives some people natural talent and he gives some people work ethic. And he is not shy about saying that God did not give me any talent. He only gave me work ethic. But speed skating is where I've been able to maximize all my potential. And yeah, I definitely am sad that I don't, you know, put on makeup and put on cute dresses and match everything. I'm sad that I don't get to go out and put on a show and perform like that. But I do perform in my own right.
Is there too much comparison with Bonnie Blair having two very dominating, I mean, performers up and coming, and obviously a great track record of Bonnie's, but did both from Champaign, do you get too many questions about that now?
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, I just want people to realize that she was long track and I was short track, so the sports are very different. The results are very different. But she's definitely a huge inspiration for me. I got really serious about speed skating after she came to speak at my high school, and she just told a big group of athletes about what it took for her at age 16 to go off and be top 8 in the world. And here I was, 16 at the time, thinking like, I'm not even top 8 in the country. I have so much work to be doing right now. And she talked about commitment and sacrifices, and that was the day where it was really like, you know what, I'm going to give it my all and take it as far as it'll go. If I don't make the Olympics, if I don't even make the national team, that's fine. But I'm going to commit and sacrifice and do what it takes to get there. So she's definitely a big part of my skating career.
You ever stop and think, I didn't really have the life of a normal teenager. Your parents were taking you to St. Louis for all this training. And instead of going to a movie with friends or something like that.
This is the first year that I haven't really missed a normal life. For the past 5 years, which is about as long as I've been training away from home, I've always felt like, man, I left home too early, or, you know, I gave up too many fun times in high school driving to St. Louis and up to Milwaukee to train all the time. But this is the first year, I mean, I have to assume it's just because the Olympics are over, where I'm like, you know what, I've got a pretty good life. And I get to come home every end of March, April, and beginning of May, and I get to have a normal life and see my friends and have a good time. But I know that when I go out to Salt Lake, that's when the sacrifices start. I love to speed skate, but I don't necessarily like living in Salt Lake. I hate living away from my friends and family. So when I come home in May, I try extra hard, not to be normal, but just to get every bit of all the things that I love about Champaign. And then when I go to Salt Lake, I know that, you know, in order to be great at what you're doing, you have to sacrifice those things. So it's hard, but I feel like I'm so beyond being normal. I can't really come back home and fake it every once in a while. Like, I'm over it. I'm a freak, I guess.
Are you still planning to trade in the medals to help your parents with their basement?
Well, I've never had the intention of trading in the medals. I've gotten quite a few offers for people to buy them, and I'm taking all of my Olympic winnings and I'm using it to rebuild the foundation on my parents' house. And the USOC does pay for medals as well as some of my individual sponsors pay extra bonuses for medals. So the medals are staying with me, but any money earned from them is going to my parents' house.
I have to ask, did your parents freak out, or maybe any friends or old teachers, when Stephen Colbert signed your thigh?
Actually, my parents were in the audience. So a lot of people have been like, oh my God, what's your parents say? And I was like, they're actually there when we made the decision. Like I brought Stephen Colbert's book along, and I was saying backstage like, oh, I'm going to have him sign my book. And my agent was like, Catherine, forget the book. You should have him sign your thigh. And I thought that was just hilarious, and so I asked him on the air, and my parents thought it was great, and I think it's great. It's definitely one of the number one things that I get asked about, even more than Bonnie Blair. But just to have him speechless for the little bit that I did, totally worth it. I'll answer questions the whole rest of my life if I have to.
And he was a big supporter. I know there was a bank that went under during that
time. There was a Dutch bank that went out of business, and they were giving us $350,000 a year to help support all the athletes. There's long track and short track, and then long track is split up into two teams. There's all around sprinters, and then the short track team is all on its own. So we all have to go to different separate World Cups. We all have our own coaches. Each team has its own coaches. And to lose that much money on an Olympic year, we can't pay for flights, we can't pay registration fees, we can't pay for ice time. To have Stephen Colbert step in and gather together his Colbert Nation to help us out, like, it really made the Olympic experience, the Olympic experience for us, because we could have lost out on a lot of great things, and it could have detrimentally hurt our performance if he wasn't there to help us.
Outside of competition, was there one really nerve-wracking moment, whether it was winning a medal or being on Colbert Report or the Today Show or something? Is there an interview you did that where somebody you were particularly psyched or just really worried about?
Oh, man. You know what? I really don't mind talking to the media. I have no problem opening up, answering questions. So I know a lot of people, they do kind of clam up and they get really nervous. I was definitely very anxious for Stephen Colbert. And, you know, just the Olympics in general, every time I got it on the ice, I was too excited. And I feel like my results did not indicate my performance at the Olympics. Like, I could have done so much better. And the way I performed even, I could have gotten such better results, and it was just those nerves. The mistakes I made were rookie mistakes, mistakes that I have never made in my life, even when I was just starting out. So, you know, the 7th in the 500 and the 4th in the 1500, while, like, you know, I'm happy with those, I feel like I did the best I could have done. Just being at the Olympics, being on such a big stage, definitely held me back from being as great as I could have been.
And when you're training again, are we just looking ahead to the next Winter Games, or what's next for you?
Training starts in May, and then, yeah, it's four years of training until 2014. We do have 6 World Cups every year and a World Championship, so there's still plenty of competition involved in the next 4 years. But the way that every training season goes, you start training in mid-May. You don't compete until maybe the middle of September. So you have 4 months of just training, 8-hour days, maybe even 9 hours on hard days. And then starting in September, then it's just a really slow peak all the way until March. And it's we don't use very much sports science, but it's very scientific in the way that you do it. Like, it's more like a feeling that you learn the longer that you train. You know, when your body has hit certain cycles, certain peaks and valleys, and you have to be sure that you feel like you're in a valley all the way until the end of March, which is when we have our World Championships, and then you pretty much stop training completely, and it causes a huge supercompensation in your body, and you're able to perform lap times, full sets, faster, longer, stronger than you've ever done them before. So it's very, training is very tricky, and that's why we need 4 years to really get it right for the Olympics. I feel like I have 5 years of training under my belt now, so I'm pretty in tune with my body, but there are so many other types of training that I can learn and I can improve with if I just find them out in the next 4 years.